Good morning, it's 7:34, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter. Exactly 1 year after the violent white nationalist rally, Unite the Right, in Charlottesville, many of the same groups are planning an anniversary rally this weekend in Washington, D.C. On this anniversary, we speak with Sammy Rangel, Executive Director of Life After Hate. Founded by formerly violent extremists, Life After Hate is dedicated to helping individuals exit hate groups. In his autobiography, Forebears, The Myths of Forgiveness, Sammy Rangel talks about his journey from the physical and sexual abuse suffered as a child to his path of transformation. So, Sammy Rangel, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, no worries. It's my pleasure.
So how did you get out of what you would call it a hate group or a mentality of hate?
Before I met a bunch of the people that I know today in this field, I thought my situation was very isolated, but it seems to be a theme. Up until the point where I decided to get my life together, I felt completely alone, uncared for. I felt that no one could really appreciate what the suffering I had been through, much less acknowledge that I had suffered in any way, shape, or form. And so I just kind of felt like the world had deaf ears and wasn't going to hear anything I ever had to say. So it was me against the world. And it wasn't until I met a man who saw past all my defenses, all my hatred, all my tactics and anger and behavior, how dangerous I was and, you know, how violent I was, you know, and he simply treated me with kindness. And I could even say, even from the onset, just a very loving nature coming from this man. And I wasn't prepared for that. I wasn't prepared to be that, to be treated that way. And I was completely disarmed, probably because I was so disoriented by how kind and empathic and compassionate he was. I was completely disoriented by that. I had never experienced that. And at the time that I had that encounter with this guy, I was probably at the lowest point of my life that I could possibly take my life. And yet here was somebody who broke the norm of what I would say is my global narrative by being something other than I thought all people were. And it's sad because it really was just him being a good listener and kind and compassionate, which we all think that we possess the ability to use and to have, but very few of us really tap into it in that way. And it came through very simple gestures of just hearing my story without judging it or evaluating it or evaluating me or judging me, just listening to what my experience was like. And that set everything else in motion for me. Still took a couple of years before I got my act together, and it was a struggle. But that opened up my defenses enough to start letting in this idea that maybe there was something that I was doing that wasn't working for me.
And what led you to the group Life After Hate?
I got out of prison 18 years ago. This would be my 19th year. I got out in 99. And I knew before I got out of prison, you know, I had made my decision to change while incarcerated, while in a program. And I knew that I was going to go into the field of social work, addictions counseling. I wanted to work with kids who had been abused like me, gang members, of course, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I started following that path. And one thing led to another. You know, I started working with kids who had stories like mine. And then I realized, like, some of them are still being abused, and so we need to help these kids, which meant that we needed to do something for the family. And then you start working with the family, and you realize that the family needs resources and services. So now you got to start working with the community. And then you work with the community, you realize there's all these hurdles and obstacles and things in the way, or just even just the lack of services for people. And so now you got to start building systems to try to accommodate or meet the need of the people. And then you realize, like, at a certain point, there's like this, like, these policies and these politics and these rules and these laws and these ordinances that make it hard for a person to have basic human needs met. And so you start to advocate for that, which means you're now lobbying. And eventually, by following the breadcrumbs, it took me straight to racism. It took me straight to the bigotry that's in the world. It took me straight to taking on systems that have systemic policies built into it that oppress people. And it's no longer a surprise to me that I ended up partnering with people who are combating racism. But we're doing it in a very unique way. You know, we're not out there condemning and protesting with signs and putting people down. No, it's not like that. It's, you know, we realize that those of us who have hurt people need to provide service work. And those of us providing the service work in this country are also highly developed professionals. And we were like, let's leverage our abilities together and go back into this unseen, unknown of space that needs us. Because to be honest, when we innovated this process back in 2011, there was no other nonprofit, there wasn't another group of people thinking about putting something into place to help men and women lost to racism in these hate groups. It was just us. And when we told each other our stories, we had very similar pathways into the problems that we had and very similar pathways out of the problems that we had, because a lot of us have this theme in our lives about how somebody treated us so much better than we deserved at a time when we were in at worst, and it kind of shook us out of that hatred. It's almost like they loved us right out of hate.
And is that your approach to people when they come to you, or what is your approach?
And I want to make sure that this is clear, because I think the community sometimes doesn't understand what we mean. Our starting point on any case that we take on is to use a lens of compassion and empathy. But that does not mean that is absent of accountability, responsibility, or even natural consequences. What we're saying is that it's not our place to be judge and jury over any person. We're trying to provide a pathway out of hate for people who are willing to even consider that as an option. So we start in many of all the stuff I've been telling you about, where we start with listening, with validating, you know, and we have to listen to some pretty serious stuff that doesn't sit well with us, that makes our skin crawl or makes us cringe inside. But at the same time, we realize that if we can't tolerate that, we're not going to be able to reach into some of the darkest spaces to help people come out when they're ready for it. So our starting point is to position ourselves to be different from the norm, which is intolerant and condemning, and yet not feel the need to concede. So I think we are highly cognizant of the fact that we will not concede, you know, our position, but we will not condemn a person, you know. And so by not conceding and not condemning, we are doing enough to capture the attention of people who are willing to hear our message.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that about the idea of accountability, because that was one of my questions. Well, what's the difference between loving and enabling or condoning?
I think the major differences are the types of boundaries and limits that are in place in those relationships, right? So, you know, we're not here to help people escape the consequences of their life. We're really at a core level on many levels thinking about, you know, nationwide public safety, nationwide human rights, nationwide civil rights when it comes to these things. And one of my friends just recently sent him a quote, everyone deserves a sandwich, right? And if you get caught up in this judgment of ideologies, you will become a person who starts to deny people what they need to live. And isn't that what we're already fighting, right? People who are denying other people what they need to live. We can't adopt the values of the people that we're trying to say need our help. If we start behaving in that way, it gets really blurry and slippery, and pretty soon you can't tell the difference between what you were standing for and what you're standing against.
Well, I think it's also an issue of safety, that people don't feel safe around a white supremacist. So the natural, like you said, the gut reaction thing to do is just, I want to feel safe, so you can't be here anymore. I suppose the person is not thinking about where that person is going to go, but they just want to feel safe. Because the other side of that is, we just had an incident here in Oakland, California, where a young black woman who was stabbed on the platform by a white.
That.
Yeah. So that's the other side of it that people are thinking, is that if you make space for them, aren't you making it safer for them to do harm?
That's not the kind of comparison that comes out of what we're talking about. Remember, we're saying boundaries, limits, accountability, all of that needs to happen without us losing our heads in the call for someone else's head. Do you follow me? Like, we can't give way to the emotional appeal of insanity when trying to deal with this situation. We need to be level-headed. We need to be firm. We need to be consistent. We need to make sure that we're not removing humanity from our approach. Those things that raise the bar for us consciously, cognitively, emotionally, spiritually. Like, don't abandon that out of your anger and out of your fear. It's those things that will separate you from an extremist while you're holding them accountable. Should some of these people be in prison? Absolutely. Should some of them lose their jobs? Absolutely. But remember, where's the spirit of those decisions coming from? Is it rage and anger, and is it blind? Or is it something that has been thought out? We understand what we're doing. We know what we're doing.
So you're talking about proactive rather than reactive?
Yeah, very
cognitive. To some extent?
Yeah, it has to be high-level thinking rather than emotional reacting. Absolutely. The accountability is there. Like, there's laws in place. Use them, right? But we know that there's a difference between harsh penalties that maybe go too far. You know, we've seen the injustices of that, right? Like, here in Wisconsin, where I live, it seems that if you're a minority and you get charged for sexual assault, you're looking at 40, 50 years. But if you're not a minority and you get charged for sexual assault, you're looking at probation, right? Like, we're saying find the balance and the equality and the fairness in these accountability rules. You don't want to do not enough, and you don't want to go way overboard. So you got to find that middle ground.
And what would you say the general demographic of the people that you serve, for the most part, is?
Well, and the job I do now, I'm the executive director of Life After Hate, which is a nonprofit that is focused on helping men and women leave white supremacy hate groups. And so obviously the vast majority of our people are, all of our people are ex-white supremacists, formers, what we call them. We have a range of young people who are older, and even within their own ranks, what people don't understand is that there is a plethora on varieties of types of white supremacy or violent far-right extremism. You know, there's Christian identity, you can be a Klan member, you can be a skinhead, and they're all very different, although they, on the surface, if you don't know much more other than that, they just look like white racists. But one group might not identify with the other group. One group might be more focused on anti-government, one might be more on anti-gay, anti-Muslim, anti-whatever, right? And when you start dealing with that, you realize that your population is pretty diverse. There are some people, you know, like what we saw in Charlottesville, where people were in button-ups, you know, nice haircuts, looked young, looked well-fed. They didn't look grungy or like coming from the ghetto, or, you know, they weren't shaved, bald, with tattoos everywhere and, you know, t-shirtless. Like, it's the demographic is all over the place. And as you look online, you see that there are elderly people who are, you know, letting out all this viral hatred language towards people. There's young, there's rich, there's poor. It's all over the place. But it's this common theme that somehow they're superior, and they are somehow being replaced and denied. So there are really no boundaries here. There's well-educated, uneducated, rural to urban. I mean, it's all over the place right now.
So how, as a man of color, did you become interested in working with this group?
Well, you know, as a social worker, I'm constantly taking on social justice issues, and kind of like what I said, the breadcrumbs of working with inner city kids who are a lot like me led me down this path of taking on systemic injustice. You know, it took 20 years to get here, but I just kept following the breadcrumbs and realized, like, I needed to take this issue on to alleviate all those other problems that I grew up dealing with in the field. Like, I grew up working with gang kids and then dealing with addiction and then mental health and then resources and then incarceration. And then you realize, like, there's systems and policies and rules, and, you know, there's practices, that, whether it's in corrections or law enforcement or the way they fund or don't fund programs. Like, having to follow all of that led me to understanding that I need to address and take on some of these bigger issues, which a lot of people avoid because of how big it is, how the magnitude of it is. But to be honest, at a gut level, a human level, the guys I work with, Tony, Angela, in the beginning it was Arno and Frankie and TJ, these guys are just, you know, while they're ex-white supremacists, and that's kind of what people want to talk about, the level of concern and humanity and regret and remorse and compassion and dedication that they have to the world and doing service work around alleviating some of the harm by getting in there and trying to do something to dismantle all that hate, it was a natural connection for me, because as strongly as they felt about their mission, I felt about my mission. And this is when we came together in Ireland back in 2011 at a summit against violent extremism. We said, you know, we could probably do so much more together than we are doing apart. And it was all kind of like this. We all had the same idea and the same feeling about it. 2 months later, after we got back from Ireland, man, we launched this nonprofit. We've been running with it ever since.
So Charlottesville, that was the Unite the Right rally that happened. And the anniversary is coming up August 11th through the 12th. And then there was Trump's comment that there were very fine people on both sides, which seemed to indicate to people that the president of the United States is supported by hate groups. What do you think it means when the president of the United States is openly sympathetic to hate groups that support
him? Well, it's a false equivalency. If you take out the 9/11 attacks and you take out the Timothy McVeigh bombing, in the last 10 years, 74% of all violent extremism committed on U.S. soil has been by domestic terrorist groups who align with white supremacy. Less than 2% of all violent extremism has come from the left. But if you remember, he called it the alt-left. That it's a false equivalency. The numbers do not support that whatsoever. What I think happens is that, and I think it's been a part of what's making our work a little harder, is that because there doesn't seem to be a clear line of accountability, responsibility, right and wrong, it is sending a mixed message to our community. And so I think it's emboldened some of our community. We're starting to understand why white supremacy groups feel that Trump speaks for them, and it has a lot to do with how close Trump's nationalism view of the state of affairs aligns with the grievances of some of these groups, right? So we're losing our jobs, America First, political correctness, all that stuff that came out of the left from civil rights that has been pissing people off for a while. These guys felt like it was right out of their playbook. We think that in the face of leadership abdicating from its responsibility to speak clearly about racism and violent extremism, that's why the communities have to do it. It's critical that the community realizes we can't leave it up to anyone else to stand up for us, to protect us. We have to do it ourselves. Activism becomes important, but we can't afford to be violent, right? And I think, you know, when we have an administration that sends out these mixed messages, we have to be there to kind of put some restore balance. And many of these groups have felt that this election win was restoring some sort of balance from earlier times. And I think we have to stay vigilant about that and realize that we're not willing to roll back the clock to previous, you know, civil rights eras. We're not willing to do that, which is why I think protesting matters, counter-protesting matters, speaking out, being activists matters. Those things still need to happen, but we cannot abandon the peacefulness of where that's come out of, you know, all the struggles with Martin Luther King and all that. We cannot just abandon that out of frustration or desperation.
And so what would you suggest that people can do?
Well, you know, I think again, protesting is important. That matters. It's great when you see on TV and you can see that these white supremacy groups are outnumbered 10-1. That's great, you know, and especially when people are maintaining, you know, their integrity while doing so. I think that's why. I think you have to show up because you don't want to not show up because abuse doesn't go away when there's no supervision. Abuse goes away when there is supervision. And the more eyes you have on a problem, the more likely you are to do something effective about it. That's one. Two, I think people need to start planning before these things hit their town. People, you need to have a contingency plan now. You need to let your community know that you stand with them, especially the people who are likely to be targeted by this. What we've heard from communities that these acts happen, you know, maybe some hateful messaging gets spread around town, or something gets vandalized, like in St. Louis with the cemetery, and then there's no reaction from the public saying, "Hey, we're against this," or, you know, "This isn't okay. This isn't who we are," or, you know, "What we stand for is community." The communities need to be vocal, and they need to let either actual victims or people that we know would be targets, that they're not alone, that if something were to happen as a community, we stand with them. Because the worst thing that can happen, and the best way to cut yourself out of any viable solution, is to not connect with those populations within your community that are going to feel victimized when these things happen, or be victimized when these things happen. And I think the fourth thing is that when you're in the planning process of this, that you be as inclusive as possible, that it's not just your elites or your controlling, you know, bodies doing this. You have to have, you know, representation from all your minority groups, from your religious sectors, from your different social classes, your different financial class. Like, you need to be as inclusive as possible, because as they say, what you do for me, without me, you do to me. And so the communities really need to rally and make sure that there is multidisciplinary, multi-level engagement by the community. I'm working with a campus right now, and you know, we asked a few simple questions, and it became really clear right away that they're really segmented. And while they have the best of intentions, it's just a few privileged people sitting in a circle talking about how to fix everyone else's problems from their perspective. And we're like, that's not going to work. We have to expand, you know, this dialogue from here on out. And so I think there needs to be a lot of that.
Well, Sammy Rangel, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. And thank you for talking about this topic. It's important and it matters. Thank you.
Thank you.